My guest today is Dr. Kristen Lyall. Dr. Kristen Lyall is an associate professor in the Modifiable Risk Factors Program at the A.J. Drexel Autism Institute at Drexel University. She earned her doctorate in epidemiology from the Harvard School of Public Health, followed by postdoctoral training at the UC Davis Mind Institute. Subsequently, she served as a research scientist in the Environmental Health Investigations Branch of the California Department of Public Health. Her research is dedicated to exploring the modifiable factors that influence autism development. Dr. Lyall's work focuses on understanding how parental factors, prenatal exposure to environmental chemicals, and maternal dietary elements interact and correlate with autism and other neurodevelopmental outcomes. She also employs continuous quantitative measures to explore traits related to neurodevelopmental diagnosis, offering a nuanced view of the autism phenotype. Dr. Lyall plays a pivotal role in leading and participating in large-scale collaborative epidemiological studies. These studies aim to uncover insights into autism and various child health outcomes, leveraging her expertise to shape the field's understanding and approach to these conditions. With specialties in psychiatric, reproductive, and nutritional epidemiology, her research delves into broad spectrum of risk factors for autism, including exposure to air pollution, maternal prenatal hormone and protein levels, gestational diabetes, infertility treatments, and maternal autoimmune or other medical conditions. And now, my conversation with Dr. Kristen Lyall. Dr. Lyall, I would just love to understand about your medical journey or your education journey. And could you take me through that and just touch on the different stops you had and different interests?
Sure. Well, first, I'll also start off by saying thank you for inviting me to your podcast. I did my undergraduate degree at Middlebury College up in Vermont. Knew going in, I was interested in science and really started out as a biology major. I was very interested in human genetics and kind of patterns of genetics, I guess, but wasn't someone that necessarily wanted to be in the lab. And then in the latter years of my undergraduate, I got really interested in psychology. And I also started working as a part-time job as a behavioral aide for a family who had a child with autism. And that was really my introduction to autism and getting to know that family and also the counselor who worked with that family. And then after school, I worked for several years as a research assistant at Massachusetts General Hospital. In a very research active group with great people. And I think that's kind of a theme across my career is just getting to work with wonderful people. Again, got the opportunity to learn more about autism and to directly work with families. And I was administering various different assessments and tests. And so that was really interesting. And it also was my first introduction to epidemiology. So I had never even, I don't know that I'd heard the word epidemiology, until my experience in that research group, where one of the investigators was an epidemiologist. And the more that I learned about that field, the more it really kind of spoke to me and seemed like it could be a fit for my interests and kind of bringing together the different substantive areas that I was interested in but applying the methods and the research design and the statistics. And so that was when I applied to a couple epidemiology programs to get a doctorate or PhD, and ended up going to Harvard School of Public Health. And there I got really interested in, so I was in the psychiatric epidemiology track. I also got interested in, there are all these other, you know, subfields of epidemiology. It's not just infectious diseases. It's not just cancer epidemiology. It's really kind of using those methods to study a whole range of different things from a kind of population perspective. And so I got interested in nutrition as well there. And then following my time, in graduate school, I did a postdoc at, UC Davis Mind Institute. And by that time I had done quite a bit of work. My dissertation was focused on autism. Again, working with really great mentors, I was given the opportunity to help kind of lead a study while in graduate school. And so had learned so much about autism, done a lot of research kind of as a student. But the Mind Institute was a really wonderful postdoc experience because it had a much kind of broader training across areas that I didn't really previously have training in. So things like immunology, neurology, neuroimaging, all these other aspects, and then also the clinical exposure, because I wasn't trained in kind of clinical assessments. I'd done some different measures, but, you know, hadn't been trained in diagnosing autism. And so there was really that kind of well-rounded training. And then from there, actually went to work as an epidemiologist at the California Department of Public Health. Again, working with great people in an environmental group. And then after about a year there, I switched to my current role, which is at the A.J. Drexel Autism Institute of Drexel University, and I'm currently an associate professor. And I've been at Drexel for about 8 years now. So, yeah.
What took you to Drexel?
It was wonderful living in California, I will say that, but most of my family is on the East Coast. And then I was also, so there was the family and the personal component, but there were really great people at the Autism Institute at Drexel, and I was really excited about the opportunity to work with them. And I think also I've kind of always been drawn to the academic environment where, you know, you're doing the research, but you also get to work with students and mentor students. And so those were some big reasons, but it definitely wasn't easy to leave California.
Yeah. Tell me about the role of an epidemiologist with autism, because it doesn't, one, I just should say that I love this because it adds a little bit of diversity into the research, which I think anytime that happens in science, it's a huge bonus. But it's not something that you often hear about or see.
Yeah, so there are different kind of aspects to epidemiology. So one that I would say plays a big role in autism is kind of the descriptive epidemiology side. And that might sound kind of very basic. We're basically counting numbers, you know, how many people have a given condition. And for autism, a huge factor, of course, is that the prevalence has increased so much over the past several decades. So when I began in the early 2000s, autism was still considered a very rare condition. The prevalence had been increasing since about the early 1990s, but was really on a very sharp upward trajectory that has continued. And epidemiology is the reason why we have those numbers. It's the methods that go into the counting and obtaining accurate estimates of autism. And so those surveillance efforts are kind of one side of the autism epidemiology piece. And of course, when we know that the prevalence has been increasing so much, that can also help to stimulate research into kind of what I would consider the other side of epidemiology, or another portion of it is trying to figure out why a given outcome or condition is occurring. Are there people who are more susceptible to given conditions, or what are the risk factors or contributing causes to a given condition? And so that's the other kind of portion of where epidemiology comes in, is trying to understand causes of a condition, where and why and how it's occurring. And the last thing I would say is that, and as you mentioned, you know, science is really better when we bring people together from different fields. And so while I'm an epidemiologist and I work with a lot of other epidemiologists, I'm always working also with people from other fields too. And I think that's what, you know, keeps the work moving forward and helps make sure that, okay, I'm not an expert in immunology. I've had a little bit of training on it, but I'm going to work with this person over here that is an expert so that we can help try and learn more.
Yeah, that's wonderful. In science, we have that silo. We often hear about the silo, yes, which we just built up, which is a good thing, because for that specific subject, you know, we're increasing our knowledge and data set about that. But with something especially as so broad as autism, it's good to have expand the edges outward and upward, I think. So,
yeah, it was for sure. We always try and work in interdisciplinary teams so that we're not, you know, looking at things from only one perspective. And
tell me about modifiable risk factors.
Sure. So, you know, I mentioned having an early interest in human genetics, and so we know, of course, autism is something with a very high genetic contribution to it. There's a high heritability to autism, but we also know that heritability and genetic background is very complex, and you know, I spent some time working in some laboratories and doing some lab work. I think, you know, learning more about nutrition and environmental chemicals and sort of all these things in the environment that we're exposed to, I get really interested in, okay, what are the pieces of this puzzle that we have some control over, or that can be modified, or that, you know, shift different aspects of how outcomes present, or co-occurrence of outcomes. And so I think it's, to some extent, it's that idea of being able to change and modify things. So when we talk about modifiable risk factors, I think more on the environmental side, things that we have control over to change. It doesn't always mean that they're easy changes. You know, when we look at various environmental toxicants, oftentimes those require policy and regulation to change. So we're not always talking easy modification, but that's kind of one component there to thinking about factors that are possible to change. I'm also growing increasingly interested in kind of interactions across different factors. So, are there dietary components that mitigate the effects of some of these environmental chemicals that we're exposed to? And there is some growing evidence that that's occurring. Maybe we can't really control our air pollution levels, but we can take a prenatal vitamin that might help mitigate some of the effects of some of those air pollutants.
Okay. That's something that I'm curious about. If whatever it is that we have in our biology that is used to kind of fight off of these environmental risk factors, is it that we're declining in our ability to fight off disease or these risk factors, or are they these risk factors just increasing? In other words, I guess, is it we're lacking what we used to before the 1930s, or is it just an overwhelming amounts of the environmental risk factors? I don't know the answer to that, but it is very fascinating to me.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a good question. I don't know the answer necessarily, but I do know, you know, there we're exposed to tens of thousands of chemicals in the environment, many of which are not very well regulated. And oftentimes when we do find evidence that a given chemical or class of chemicals does have adverse effects on health, you know, not just neurodevelopmental outcomes, but kind of broadly hormone disruption, and all these other different impacts on health. Oftentimes those chemicals are replaced with other chemicals, even if that one class or chemical is banned. And so this is a situation that's called regrettable substitutions. So it's a little bit of an ongoing challenge in trying to make sure that, you know, all the different things that we are exposed to in our environment are actually safe for health and regulated.
Yeah.
But for sure, you know, the number of things that we've been exposed to in our environment with increasing industrialization, use of plastics, has certainly increased exposures that have the potential to adversely impact health.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was wondering or think about, is the industrialization, because it fits the timelines, and it everything about it just makes sense. But I don't have data on it. But there are some things that you mentioned that I've already listed out for some questions, and the most pressing one is, since you mentioned diet, but maybe other like prenatal vitamins and such. Are there certain diets that can mitigate the risk of autism? I guess what I'm trying to say is there like an approach or preparation that families can take to kind of reduce the risk going into pregnancy?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I think my first response is to remember how complex autism is. And so I always get a little bit worried when we focus on one risk factor in trying to pitch it as something that is going to, you know, be the one factor that is going to be this, you know, going to reduce risk for a given individual. But that said, there are, you know, over a dozen studies at least now that have found an inverse association between taking a prenatal folic acid supplement, a prenatal vitamin that is rich in folic acid, especially in that early part of pregnancy. There are a number of studies that have examined other dietary factors, and you mentioned a specific diet, right? And so that brings to my mind what we call dietary patterns. So these are routine ways of eating across a whole series of foods and nutrients. And so there have been a handful of studies that have looked at these kind of broader patterns of eating during pregnancy, and we haven't really found very strong associations there. We've done a couple of studies where we've looked at specific foods, and in particular, fish intake. Now, fish are interesting because they're the primary source of polyunsaturated fatty acids. And there's a particular PUFA, or polyunsaturated fatty acid, that is of real interest for brain development, and that's DHA. It's the most abundant fatty acid, omega-3 fatty acid in the brain. And it's really important in all of these ongoing neurodevelopmental processes that are occurring while the baby is growing inside the womb. And so we found in a couple studies that the more fish you eat, or that eating fish at all in pregnancy, has been associated with a reduced risk or likelihood of having a child with autism. That's not to say that's the only factor that's important, but it could be one contributing cause in some cases. So fish in pregnancy and reducing odds. And that may be because that fish is a good source of these brain healthy fats. The other thing I guess I should take a step back and mention, because I've been talking about mom diet or prenatal diet during pregnancy. And the reason why I've been talking more about the prenatal or pregnancy period is because we know, one, that's a really critical, sensitive time period of the baby's development. It's also when, you know, the brain structures and early neurodevelopment is being set up. And then lastly, when we look to our experts in other fields, we've seen evidence that that's when some of the pathways to develop autism really begin early in gestation or during gestation. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that, you know, autism can be diagnosed, prenatally or at birth, but it's to say that some of the differences that we see in the brain are beginning during pregnancy.
Yeah.
And so when we think about likelihood of developing autism, we're all often studying prenatal factors. And that's not at all to suggest that what happens after pregnancy doesn't matter for child development. It very much does. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of great research to show that early interventions really make huge impacts on children and their outcomes. But often when we're talking about risk factors or factors that are involved in etiology, we tend to be focusing on the very early periods of gestation.
Okay. It's a big region of interest, especially for my curiosity, is that that time frame you just described there. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about, and correct me as I say this, about some of those, I don't want to call them biomarkers, but I'm going to have to, about how you kind of quantify these and kind of establish the risk about each one.
Sure. So, I'll follow through with kind of the fish example as one exposure of interest. And so when we're doing these studies, there's lots of different ways that you can try and, you know, say, is this exposure associated with autism? So we could collect a sample of families who have a child with autism and then try and collect a sample of comparison families who have a child who does not have a diagnosis of autism, and then say, what did you eat during pregnancy? And that was, you know, 5 years ago. And then we could compare. That's called a case control study. And there's some concerns with, you know, one, remembering back, well, what did I eat during pregnancy? Or what were the different things that I was exposed to? That's not to say that that study design isn't useful for some questions, but that's a concern with that. So another type of study design is enrolling women when they're pregnant and asking them about, okay, what are you eating in pregnancy? What products are you using? And collecting biospecimens from them. So can you give us a urine sample? Can you give us a blood sample? And then waiting over time to see how their child develops. And that's called a cohort study. And so that they introduced a couple different study designs, but also to kind of note that there are, in addition to different ways we can collect information from people and group people, there are different ways that we can get information about exposure histories. And so when we collect urine samples or blood samples, we can measure all sorts of things in these biospecimens or samples that are provided. And so again, to get back to fish, so we can collect those questionnaires asking about dietary intake, we can also measure those fats that I mentioned, the omega-3 fatty acids in people's blood. And that is another way that we can say, oh, well, this person has really high DHA levels in their blood. How does that relate to these outcomes of the child? And it's a nice objective way to compare to the reported data and get an actual biological assessment that is associated or not with the outcome that we're studying of interest. And so we've done some studies where we've measured these different fats in samples collected from moms and also from newborn heel sticks and measured these fats in the blood spots that are collected in routinely from babies for neonatal screening processes and tried to see, you know, are these different levels of these fatty acids associated with autism. And like for most things with neurodevelopment, the answer is a little complicated. We haven't seen kind of very clear patterns of associations, but we did find some evidence that, well, maybe there are certain levels that are associated, maybe, you know, very low levels are associated with a certain subtype of autism, with co-occurring intellectual disability, but that's a sort of preliminary finding that needs follow-up. But those biomarkers can be really useful in different research studies that we're doing to try and get that objective measure of exposure.
Okay. It's like whenever I hear you describe that, it's like I don't want to say percentages, but I'm going to have to, I think, just because my inability to really explain what I'm thinking, but like certain percentages of risk associated with this item or in a combination of these items. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yeah. And actually, you know, I would say that's a pretty good summary. So we have different ways of trying to assign kind of risk associated with a given factor that we're studying. So one way we can think about it is, you know, the attributable risk. So what are if we've removed this risk factor from the population, what would be the corresponding reduction in cases associated with that? And there are a lot of assumptions that go along with making those, determining those statistics. But essentially, yes, you're trying to determine, okay, like how much of, the caseload is this one factor contributing? Is this factor contributing to the rise in autism prevalence? And so those are different things that we try and tease out. And when we're doing these estimates and trying to look for associations between one factor, so I mentioned we know it's never just one factor, right? Autism is so complex, and in addition to, you know, having multiple causes or risk factors within any one individual, it's also highly likely that we have different kind of sets of factors. So different combinations of factors going in to different cases. When we're looking at any one individual factor at a time, we also try and say, okay, well, what else do I need to account for when I'm looking at this association and this outcome?
Even if it's a so-called weak association, if you have multiple weak associations, it kind of like builds up and strengthens the ability to maybe have actionable steps into reducing the risk.
Yeah. So what you mentioned is it kind of thinking about the multiple hits or combinations of risk factors. So we can think about, you know, are there two risk factors that act on the same pathway that then, you know, increase susceptibility to this outcome? Or is there, you know, one factor that exacerbates the effect of another factor? I like to think about factors. What are there factors that mitigate the effects of risk factors? And so we're trying, more people now that we have, you know, more large scale studies and databases with autism information. I think we're kind of in the era now where we're going to see more consideration of combinations of risk factors. In the past, we've been kind of limited by smaller sample sizes, often, not always. But it can be hard to look at combinations of risk factors together when you have a small sample, because then it gets to statistical power. And do you have enough people in each category to be able to do what you were talking about? Okay, what's the percentage increase or decrease associated with this factor? So that's where, you know, a lot of these research efforts that are bringing together participants from all around the country have been really helpful. So I'm involved, for example, in one study that's a national consortium. It's called the Environmental Influences on Child Health Outcomes, or ECHO study program. And it has brought together existing studies that across the country, and it has pooled data and is now collecting new data all under the same common measure. But it what that has done has been, it's allowed us to have much larger sample sizes than have typically been seen in any one study of autism.
It's like you're evolving a biomarker, in my opinion. Like, we can take a biomarker from a test, lab test, whatever, however the method, but you're evolving it and a little bit of making it like a step farther in toward or for understanding, I think. And I just love that so much. And I hope more will get onto this, because I think this is says very promising outcomes. And it seems to me. What I was reviewing your paper, and I just love this paper, in Annual Reviews of Public Health, where there's many items listed and parsed out. Can you tell me a little bit about, maybe I'll start with immune factors or hormone and protein factors?
Sure. Well, so I should note that as with all work I do, that paper was definitely a team effort. And I've mentioned, you know, how grateful I am to all the mentors I've had, but also to all the collaborators that I get to work with. And these are people, you know, who are experts in their own fields. And so the immune piece of autism and immunology in itself is very interesting. And so one thing that I've learned a lot along the way is actually during gestation, the immune system really has a lot of crosstalk with neurodevelopment, which, you know, is something that I didn't know before I was a postdoc. And so there have been a lot of studies that have shown kind of various maternal immune activation factors. So mom autoimmune diseases, fever during pregnancy, infection during pregnancy, and related those different factors to an increased risk of autism or likelihood of the child developing autism. There have also been some studies that have made use of biomarkers and looked at patterns of cytokines or pro-inflammatory markers and different immune markers, and found some specific associations. And I've been lucky to get to work with some colleagues in California who've led a population-based case control study that have really focused in on a lot of immune markers in autism and learned a lot about how those relate to autism. And one interesting finding there is that there did seem to be kind of a general pattern of associations with some of these immune markers, specifically for autism, with co-occurring intellectual disability. And I think that's sort of an example of, you know, we know how complex and diverse autism is. You know, we have this one diagnostic label for what really represents a very broad phenotype and diversity of, you know, strengths and challenges. And I think it is interesting when we can pull apart factors that might put a child or an individual on a pathway to one kind of subgroup of that broader category, because it helps us learn a little bit more about kind of the underlying biological pathways. Another thing you mentioned, so hormone influences in autism. And so there's been a lot of interest in thyroid hormones. So we know thyroid hormones are so important in neurodevelopment. All babies are screened and moms during pregnancy for their thyroid hormone levels. And so there have been a number of studies that have looked at both mom thyroid hormone levels, and there are a couple different ones that are measured during pregnancy, as well as baby in those newborn heel stick and other biospecimens, and examined associations with those. And, you know, the results have been a little bit inconsistent, so I don't think we have necessarily a clear picture there. But I have a student who is using some different statistical methodologies, and there seem to be some differences kind of across levels of autism traits. So it may be important to consider again, kind of what are those subgroups or subphenotypes within autism? Do we get a clearer picture of how this biomarker, this exposure might be related to this outcome?
Thyroid is a region of interest, and it you're right, it is across data.
Yeah, and that's been one reason why there's a lot of interest in a class of chemicals called endocrine disrupting chemicals, or EDCs, because we know that they, as the name implies, disrupt hormone levels. And so there's been a lot of interest in those chemicals and whether they relate to autism specifically and also neurodevelopment more broadly, and evidence that these are, you know, important chemicals to be considering and regulating.
Yeah. The tyrosine, synthesizing it from tyrosine is a very fascinating story, I think, because it's an aromatic amino acid. It's a very strange or rare special type of amino acid. And yeah, there's only three of them, and it's how they're synthesized is very unique. And we can see that there's a lot of people that's like on thyroid medicine now that have disrupted thyroids, which is very kind of problematic and goes back to the environmental risk factors that we're talking about. It's very much in line with this modern life, I think. Something I was wanting to talk to you about is, you mentioned like something like as simple as a fever or something that's really even acute within pregnancy might increase the risk of this neurodevelopment at this time frame that really disrupts the progression or, yeah, the process of the neural development being typical developed. Is something so brief like that known to play a factor in maybe this child will now develop autism?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think there are a couple different threads in there. And so one is the piece of critical windows, right? When is this specific factor happening? And can something so acute actually have such a, you know, a big impact on development? And so we take, for example, folic acid and neural tube defects. So if you're really low or deficient in folic acid, if that's occurring in the what we call the periconceptional window, when the neural tube is forming, then the baby can end up with these neural tube defects, which are, you know, catastrophic. And so that's the reason why we fortify and we recommend folic acid supplementation in the early part of pregnancy. And so that's the critical window aspect. And so we do have evidence, yes, that certain exposures, that timing really matters. They have a much stronger effect, and that's because of the neurodevelopmental processes that are happening. It's, you know, lining up the exposure just at the right or wrong window of when these developmental processes are happening and when they're most susceptible to some sort of environmental insult. Now, the other piece, you know, can fever once during pregnancy actually cause autism? And that's kind of a loaded question, right? And so I think the other piece that's important to remember there is there's the genetic background, right? And so not everyone who gets fever during pregnancy develops a child, or their child goes on to develop autism. And so we have to remember, you know, maybe it's fever combined with something else, or maybe it's fever combined with the genetic background plus three other factors. It's this whole kind of interaction, and we call them causal pies in epidemiology. It's all the different pieces that come together. But interestingly, for both infection and fever, there have been suggestions that, you know, when we look at fever in the, I think it's the third trimester, I might be saying that wrong. I can't remember if it's the first or the third, but there have been stronger signals or evidence for an association in a specific trimester with those. So that's kind of another component there. And then, you know, there's also, we have to consider, you know, the mom's health matters too, right? So mitigating the effects of that fever, it's important to get the fever under control. So anytime we're looking at a medical condition, of course, you have to consider, you know, what's the impact on the mom's health too? And is the mother taking some sort of medication for that condition? And then we get into questions about, well, is the medication causing any sort of impacts? And then there's this kind of balancing of risks and benefits. And I think we're still learning more about, you know, all these different components, but certainly evidence that when a mother does have a fever, it's important to, you know, address that.
Wow. It could be so sensitive. I had a doctor, a surgeon on from Duke, who's now doing umbilical cord stem cells on autistics. And he done it on his son. And his son was almost nonverbal. And the way he describes it is about 2 weeks out later, 2-3 weeks later, I mean, now he's completely, he lives independent. You know, he has like a girlfriend. It just like helped him so much. And I'm thinking as I hear more about this, it's like that umbilical cord is rescuing whatever insults from the placenta to womb that probably occurred during pregnancy.
That's interesting. I'm not super familiar with that research. It's certainly interesting. I know there's a lot of interest in stem cells. I think for, you know, when we're looking at things in epidemiology studies, we're trying to get those population level effects. So rather than, you know, is this something that has impacted one person, it's more looking at large groups of people and trying to glean and determine what at the population level are contributors to this outcome.
Yeah, it's like what we mentioned earlier about maybe this thing is weak, but as you build up, it kind of just strengthens whatever it is, the topic of interest there. That's incredible. Air pollution is something that's heavily researched.
There's been an explosion of air pollution studies over the past decade, 1 to 2 decades. I think the first paper looking at air pollution and autism, I think, was 2012. So not that long ago. And I think, you know, the reason why there's a lot of interest in air pollution is everyone's exposed to it, right? So even if the effects are small, you know, or it only impacts for certain individuals, whatever the case may be, it is this ubiquitous factor that is really everywhere. And we know that there are certain pollutants in the air that do have impacts on development, neurodevelopment, all kinds of outcomes, asthma and airways, overall health. So it's certainly an exposure that people have been paying a lot of attention to. And I believe there's some, you know, emerging and ongoing animal studies that have, you know, demonstrating some biologic pathways that actually help to support the association, things like oxidative stress, inflammation.
Yeah, oxidative stress is definitely a question.
And that's related, of course, also to input. Those are two kind of interlinked pathways. And so we did a study actually trying to measure biomarkers of oxidative stress in mothers. And this was in a relatively small study, but some colleagues of mine developed this study where families who already had a child with autism were contacted and asked if they were going to be getting pregnant again. And so then those families were followed through their next pregnancy to allow for that kind of cohort model and prospective follow-up from pregnancy through early development. And you know, just wonderful participation in these studies that really help drive the research. And the mothers provided biological specimens, and we've been able to measure all sorts of different things in these samples. And so we measured isoprostanes and other markers of kind of generalized oxidative stress to try and see, you know, are these biomarkers during pregnancy that are indicators of increased oxidative stress, are they related to later outcomes of autism? And again, didn't see very strong associations, but some potential kind of signals for, you know, different patterns. So something that I think could be expanded upon in larger studies and trying to tease apart, you know, do we see different associations with different subgroups?
What is something recently that you're most excited about?
Well, I'm really excited. I mentioned the ECHO program, that large consortium. I'm really excited about getting to participate in that network. One, because that, you know, it allows for things that we haven't always been able to do yet in autism research with the larger numbers, at least for the type of work that I do focused on nutrition and environmental chemicals. And then I'm really excited about looking at interactions and thinking about not just one factor at a time, but okay, what can we get a little bit more of a holistic picture about how all these puzzle pieces fit together, right? Not just one at a time, but okay, what's the effect of this one and this one, especially if we have some kind of, you know, pathway that we think they're both acting on, or, you know, one is going to resolve the impacts of this factor on another pathway. And so we have a study now that is looking at does prenatal diet modify the effects of air pollution exposure on autism? And that's a study funded by NIEHS. And so we're delving into those results now. But I'm really interested in kind of expanding that line of work, and then also trying to learn more about, you know, all the good and bad things in diet. So we've got these beneficial nutrients, but we also have highly packaged and processed foods that it can be a source of chemical exposures. What can we learn about, you know, their intake in children and how that's impacting child health? So I've focused mainly on prenatal diet, but what about the child diet side? Mm-hmm. And how does that modify? And we know that children with autism and individuals with autism can often have, you know, food sensitivities and highly restricted diets, and you know, that presents all sorts of challenges in its own right. I think any parent can tell you that it can be hard to get their kid to eat vegetables and to eat a healthy diet. But I think, you know, when you're working within the realm of autism, that whole kind of landscape changes even further. And so what can we do to help support the lives of these families and individuals in a way that improves supports and outcomes? And so I'm excited to learn more about kind of, you know, the ongoing child pieces and how that may kind of modify different outcomes within autism. And we've also kind of been expanding in different ways to think about learning more about kind of the health and well-being of the family unit and supporting mom health. You know, I think when you've been in autism research for a long time, you really get a lot of great interaction with families and really are grateful for the research participation and for hearing back from families. And so, you know, I think it's important to think about ways that we can give back and help support as well.
Autism is a very pressing topic for many people, and for good reason. Yeah. And I'm glad that people are like that and, you know, participating, and it's just so pressing. The rates are pressing. With the food sensitivity, it's like there's so many autism and XYZ conditions. I always, like, there's so many comorbids, and GI problems is one that's really high, and like the food sensitivity and so forth. It's like finding out how to fix this is just incredible, and I'm so looking forward to the data that you just described. Is there a place that we can look for your research and this data in the future?
That's a great question. Yeah. So again, I'm going to shout out the ECHO network again. I think they do a really nice job of providing research. And this is not just my work. There's a whole list of wonderful collaborators. But there's a large focus on, okay, let's not make science so hard to access and
yes,
to understand, right? And so there's a whole page that summarizes, you know, research study across everything that ECHO is looking at. And so that's a site that I would direct people to. It's echochildren.org. And it provides, you know, one-liner summaries of research summary studies that have been recently published, as well as kind of longer summaries. And so that's one place. The more scientific technical side of things, PubMed is, you know, searching on there, but those are often kind of more directed at the researcher side or scientist side audience. And although I will say some journals do a really nice job of making sure that there's a lay summary, that we're, you know, not just directing results and findings to one audience only, but really trying to make sure that they're accessible and reachable and understandable to anyone who wants to access that information. Individual studies. So I mentioned that one cohort, the early study, has its own website. And I'm sure I'm forgetting other different resources to find these things, but those are kind of some of the major ones. And the NIH also lists summaries, which also includes lay summaries of different projects that they're funding, and that can be another resource to find out about what are some ongoing projects that are going on in autism addressing these topics as well as others.
Yeah, I just appreciate your actionable tools that you're providing for families. I think it's very incredible. And
We have a lot more work to do, that's for sure. Hoping that we can, you know, provide some information that can be useful to people.
Yeah, I'm hoping for the day that we can have this preparation, like preparing going into pregnancy, and it will just do great wonders to the risk, or the rates, I should say. I can't thank you enough. I'm very excited about your role, the epidemiology aspect of this. And I think this is just incredible information.
So, thank you so much. And I'm always happy to answer questions. And again, really appreciate the invitation to come and spend time with you and talk about my work a little bit.
Yeah, it's very valuable information. So I'll put some links in the show notes and promote it on social media, the little social media that I'm on. But yeah, I just want to get your message out.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It's been so nice to get to talk to you.
Yeah, I appreciate you interacting with me. If you're listening to the podcast or listening to the episode, please feel free to leave a review or ratings. In podcasting, review and ratings are crucial, and I very much appreciate your feedback. You can contact me on X at RPS47586. Or click on the Hop link so you can have links to all the show platforms and contact information. You can email me info.fromthespectrum@gmail.com. And thank you for listening to From the Spectrum Podcast.